Case number 13-1174 et al., Music Choice Appellant v. Copyright Royalty Board. Mr. Hellman for the appellant, Mr. Faulkner for the appellant, Ms. McNeil for the appellee, and Mr. Larson for the intervener.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Matt Hellman on behalf of Sound Exchange. There have been a lot of numbers invoked in this case, but the one that really matters is 13%. The board below set satellite royalty rates using simple but flawed logic. First, they said the market rate was no more than 13%. Then they said only a minor adjustment was necessary to have that rate satisfy the statutory factors under Section 801B, and the result was rates that topped out at 11%. The problem here is the starting point. There was no evidence, I believe literally none, that 13% was a market benchmark. No party said that 13% was a market rate. No party had the opportunity to respond to the contention that 13% was a market rate. The judges simply deemed 13% to be the market rate in lieu of the actual and current evidence presented in the record. Now, on appeal, the government has sought to defend the use of 13% in a variety of ways, but none of them can cure that basic and fundamental problem. The government makes much of the fact, as did the CRJs in the proceeding below, that Sound Exchange proposed rates that began at 12%. And the government argues that because Sound Exchange said that rates could begin at 12%, it was reasonable for the CRJs to find that 13% represented the top of the market range. But of course, that's comparing apples to oranges.
Well, can I just ask you, there's something a little bit odd about saying that you can't consider 13% when the whole statute is based on this idea that what we're going to try to figure out is, we have a backdrop rate, and do we need to do something different? And 13%, I take the point that 13% isn't actually the backdrop rate, 8 is.
Correct.
But as the copyright judge said in their decision, the 8 came from the 13.
They did come from the 13, Your Honor. And there might be many ways to set rates working from first principles. But what these judges did was say, we're going to find, as they have in the past, what a market rate is. That's a fact of the world. That's not an empirical judgment about what might make sense to move to or how quickly to go from an existing rate to a current rate. There's just a factual question out there. What is the market rate? What is the comparable market rate for these rights? 13% is not the answer.
But where did they say that 13% is a market rate as opposed to it's a relevant rate that we're going to take into consideration?
Well, I think it's the only possible conclusion from the opinion. If you begin at JA 733, they set out their two-step process. We quote it at page 4 of our brief. And what they do is what they've done in the past. I can quote from the opinion if you'd like. The judges, quote, considered and analyzed the market benchmarks and testimony to determine a zone of reasonableness. And then second, they measured that rate or rates yielded by that process against the statutory objectives to determine, you know, where they ought to end up. If you then follow the analysis through the opinion at JA 745, JA 747, JA 749, I'll give you a couple quotes that I think are particularly evocative on this point.
Yeah.
You'll see that what they say over and over again is the range of rates, we're looking at a range of 7 to 13%. Do we need to adjust that range in light of the statutory factors? For three of the four factors, they say no adjustment is necessary. A market rate is appropriate. For one factor, the third factor, they say a slight downward adjustment.
Okay, so would you agree with me that if they just said, we're going to consider several rates that we think are in some general range of reasonableness, 13% is one of them. We understand that 13% derives from the last time around, but we still consider it to be relevant, and so we're going to take it into account. And then they do the same analysis, basically. And there's nothing in there. In fact, they go far as to say, by the way, we're not saying that 13% is a benchmark marketplace rate. It's not coming from our analysis of the marketplace now. We're just taking it into consideration because it's the functional equivalent of the going 8% rate if you take out the discount that we applied last time around. Would that be a problem?
I think so, if I'm understanding your hypothetical correctly. I'm assuming, if you're saying that there's an actual market rate of say, 22%, which is what our evidence showed, and then they said there are ways to use the prevailing rate in connection with that market rate. Absolutely. If you wanted to say, look, The market rate has gone up in the world. Things have changed. We do this proceeding every 5 years because things change. The market rate has gone up in the world. The existing rate, I would say, is 8% more than 13%, but whatever you want to compare the current situation to where you might go in the future, the statutory factors talk about ways to do that, but you can't say, I'm finding the market rate. I'm looking out there in the world and finding the market rate, and then make the adjustments from there, because what you end up doing is truncating the range in which you have to move. Keep in mind that three of the four factors here pointed directly to a market rate, no adjustment necessary. One factor they found required a slight downward adjustment from the top of that rate. If three or four factors were saying, take the market rate wholesale, and one factor saying, move a little bit from that market rate, it matters a lot if that market rate is 13% or 22% or some other number. And so that's our point here.
What's the language that you point to then in the order itself that says that they thought that 13% was actually a market benchmark?
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. One, they said this is the process we're going through. We're finding the market benchmark submitted by the parties to determine the zone of reasonable market rates. That's at 733 of the order, 23055 of the Federal Register. And then they go on to say, second, they measure those rates against the statutory factors to figure out how much to move. A good example of that is on page 747 of the JA. And I'm looking at the middle column, above the subsection minimize disruptive impact. And if you read that passage, I'm happy to read it. It concludes, therefore, the rates that the judges announced in this determination for the SDARS reflect a downward adjustment from the 12 to 13% range based upon the third section 801B factor. What they're doing there is that step two analysis, figuring out what, if any, adjustment needs to be made from the market rate of 13%.
But I think it's important, actually, that or at least it could be important, that they never actually say that. They never say that 13% is a market rate. They're saying that 13% is a rate that we're taking into consideration. And I understand the analytical framework that you've outlined, which is to say there's two steps. This appears to be part of the first step. The first step has to do with market rates. Ergo, 13% must have been a market rate, I think, which is effectively what you're saying. But I don't know that there's an obligation for them to be as tidy as that. And there would be nothing wrong, for example, if they said, under the fourth factor, we have to take into account the degree of disruption. And so in order to take into account the degree of disruption, we're going to consider 13% as a relevant rate.
You know,
Or do you think that would be a problem, too?
I guess I think
that would be a problem?
Well, 13% is – disruption says how much of a change from the current world to the future world, how much disruption will be caused.
So you think they'd have to do 8?
Well, that's the current world. I mean, I think it makes sense that's right, that if you were going to ask how disruptive something is, you wouldn't look at a rate that doesn't exist. You look at the prevailing rates.
But that is, I guess, as I read what the copyright judges are saying, they're drawing an equivalence between 13 and 8 because they're saying 8 came from 13 last time. All we did was discount because of the disruption factor.
What? If we're talking disruption, I don't want to say this is just a matter of wording, but I do think it's important. If we're talking disruption, there's an analytical move to be made saying, here are our rates today. What would it look like if we imposed the market rates that the evidence shows? I don't think 13 actually fits very well into that framework. And then just to your point that whether or not they were using 13% as a market rate, they didn't pick 13% out of the air in that sense. 13% represented the market rate that Sound Exchange submitted last time. And there's an analysis in the opinion where everybody agrees that the same target market ought to be used to find this benchmark, interactive services benchmark. And then in the opinion, and I agree with respect, it's not a model of clarity, but what they seem to say is that, well, that market rate is just too high. They say this. They say it would be a fourfold increase over the 8%. Now, that's simply not accurate. It's 22 compared to 8. Compared to 13, excuse me, which was the market rate there. And they seem to then just substitute in quickly this 13% rate because they liked the market comparison, this interactive services market, but they didn't like the rate, the market benchmark that that yielded on the evidence that...
Just so I can be clear, the term market rate does not appear in the four statutory factors at all, right?
The term market rate does not.
D does refer to disruption, but yes, it does not use the term market rate.
That's correct. And the way the CRJs have implemented those factors, though, and I think that's clear from the opinion, is they say usually the market rate will capture what those factors are concerned mm-hmm. with, but we'll make adjustments if that's appropriate.
Yeah.
So what I'd like to say is that on this point, if I may, and I realize that I've gone to my red light, this isn't simply a matter of wording or saying the right words to get to the result. I take the opinion at its word when it says, we like this interactive benchmark that you proposed, but we just don't like the... What it says is we don't accept that the rate that benchmark yields in this proceeding is the one we want to use. They're free to criticize the benchmark, and we go through our brief and explain why those criticisms aren't valid. I'm happy to talk about those. But then you can't do... There might be other ways to set a rate at that point. They might have pulled back and said, stop, we're going to do something different. These benchmarks aren't working out. But what they did instead is say, you know what, we'll just revert back to what that market showed as a benchmark before. And I think that's the only fair reading of the opinion. I don't know where the 13% comes from. Your Honor suggests that it's sort of twinned with the 8% in some way, but that not in a way that I would understand would make non-arbitrary sense for using it in this case, because if you're going to say that our plan is to find the zone of reasonableness in the market, the 7% market rate that the other side has proposed, and the 13% rate that we proposed last time but that no one proposed this time, I don't believe that analysis would
because we're focusing on the precision of words, because I think it matters. I mean, when you said the zone of reasonableness in the market.
Yes.
And I guess my question is, why does it have to be the zone of reasonableness in the market? Why can't it just be the zone of reasonable rates?
As a matter of first principles, I agree with you, Your Honor. As a matter of what they did and what they said they were doing and what they have done in the past and where the 13% came from in the prior proceeding, that 13% is working as a market rate. And you can see in the dissent, I point out, from Judge Roberts, what he said was, you know, the sound exchange benchmark, I too find it not to be entirely acceptable on its face. And he did a few more adjustments to it based on the record, based on some critiques mm-hmm. that the other side proposed. And he came out to 16%. And then he used that at the top of his range of reasonableness. Everyone here understood what was being done. And if your point is that having found benchmarks that they didn't like, could they have tried to set rates differently? I suppose they could have.
Yep.
But using this framework, no, this is not a non-arbitrary way of proceeding. Now, I realize I'm in my red light. I'll just say very briefly, if I may.
Be brief, please.
I would be brief. I would just like to say that the additional discounts from those rates yielded by this 13% or 9 to 11% with the non-music deduction and the pre-72 deduction, as we've explained in our briefs, neither of those two takeaways are necessary given how where you even if you think 13% is the rate to start with, there's no need to reduce for either of those two things.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Fackler with the firm of Aaron Fox, and I'm here today on behalf of Music Choice. Music Choice has appealed the Cuppert Royalty Judge's rate determination for the pre-existing subscription services, or PSS, as that term is defined in Section 114, the Copyright Act. The first point of error that I'd like to discuss today was the Cuppert Royalty Judge's imposition of a 13% increase in the royalty payable by the PSS, based solely on Music Choice's, at the time, planned increase in the number of channels it was going to offer to its subscribers. Now, that increase, the judges premised that increase on two assumptions. One, that the increase in channels would lead to an increase in public performances of the sound recordings, and two, that that increase in performances would not be compensated under the existing royalty rate. However, the judges did not cite any record evidence to support either one of those assumptions. And in fact, there was no record evidence to support either one of those assumptions. The judges acknowledged that there was no evidence in the record that there would be any material increase in performances. Now, the government argues that the increase can still be justified based solely on Music Choice's so-called additional usage of the sound recording. The problem with that argument is that Section 114 is not a copyright usage license. It's a public performance license. Only public performances of sound recordings are compensable under Section 114. The copyright law is clear that the mere transmission of a sound recording is not a public performance unless someone on the other end of that transmission actually listens to it.
Now, so is it not fair to assume that if you're going to expand the channels with a lot more playings that somebody's going to be listening?
No, Your Honor, because if you think about it just one step deeper, mm-hmm. a subscriber to Music Choice can only listen to one channel at a time. Okay? So if they have more channels to choose from, that doesn't somehow make them able to listen to more than one at the same time. And so there's certainly no reason a priori to assume they're going to take time away from their other activities and increase the amount of time. They would have to increase the amount of time they spent listening to music.
But why, from the industry's perspective, why expand the offerings if nobody's going to be listening?
This is why. And David Del Baccaro, the CEO of Music Choice, testified to this. And curiously, the judges, in their revised determination in footnote 5, they didn't cite his testimony, but they made the same point. Music Choice made various improvements to its service, including the channel expansion, because it needed to improve the value of the service. They believed it would make the service more valuable to consumers, and that would enable
them. The value of the service depends upon the number of listeners, or the amount of listening, I should say, doesn't it?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree with that. The fact is Music Choice gets paid per subscriber in these cable homes irrespective of how many people listen to the service. The value is in the quality of the programming. And if the programming is deemed to be more of a higher quality, of a higher value to cable subscribers, when Music Choice is in there negotiating with the cable companies every few years about how much Music Choice is going to get paid, they have a better argument against what has been a steady stream of declining per-subscriber rates that Music Choice has been able to get because of the competitive factors unrelated to music, frankly, in the cable programming market. So Mr. Del Baccaro testified at length.
Now, take it just to use your conceptual framework. An individual, I understand your point that an individual can only listen to one station at a time, but an individual obviously can spend his day in different ways. And so an individual can listen to station A for 2 hours and then go do something else for the rest of the day. But if they also have station B as an alternative, they might spend part of the rest of the day listening to station B. So it's not just that the individual has to choose between A and B for 24 hours when you take into account that the individual might be doing other things with their time.
But I think that gets to the heart of the problem, Your Honor. It could be that if one did the analysis and did the surveys necessary to figure that out, it is possible that customers would spend more time listening to Music Choice. I don't think it necessarily follows, but it is possible. The problem is none of that was in the record here.
Yeah, again, this is probably going extra record more than we ought to be, but I feel compelled to ask you, isn't a certain part of the market of Music Choice people who are not listening to the music, they are playing the music in the background while they are reading the newspaper, working the crossword puzzle, or feeding the dog, or walking the dog even?
That is certainly true, Your Honor.
And might it not change the amount of time that people have Music Choice on in the background if Music Choice is giving them more choice?
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, in that particular scenario, it wouldn't, because by definition, when you have it on in the background because you're focusing on other things, the last thing you're going to be doing is changing channels.
But you might turn the Dublin thing off altogether because it doesn't have a station, doesn't have a choice on there right then that you want to have in your background. Whereas if they did, in fact, have Armenian folk music in the background, you might turn to the Armenian folk music channel instead of turning it off.
Your Honor, that is possible. But again, the problem here is none of this was in the record of the proceeding.
I understand that. I prefaced my remark by saying I probably shouldn't be asking this.
No, that's quite all right, Your Honor, and your point is well taken. Again, there was no evidence in the record of any additional performances, and even the judges acknowledged that there was no evidence. The mere usage...
Now, your understanding of increased usage is not consistent with what the Second Circuit says.
In what respect, Your Honor?
The Second Circuit says a transmission of a performance is itself a performance, even if there's no proof that any of the potential recipients was operating his receiving apparatus at the time of the transmission.
In that case,
the increased usage itself is what we're talking about.
But that in that case, which was not the ASCAP, the U.S. case, which had to do with the transmission of downloads of actual sound recordings, that was a cable retransmission case. In that case, there was no question that that was an infringement case, okay? So the only question was, as long as there was one person receiving the signal, and it was a jurisdictional question of whether it was in Canada or the United States, as long as there was one person receiving the signal, there would be an infringement. And the facts in that case were that there were, it wasn't disputed that there were people receiving that signal. So it's on a very different footing, whereas U.S. v. ASCAP deals specifically with the transmission of sound recordings and says that, and if you think about it, the Copyright Act talks about the performance of a work to the public. It's very difficult to understand how a transmission that doesn't get listened to could be a performance to the public in that context. But even if there had been evidence of additional performance in the records,
that's not answering the question. Doesn't get listened to. If one person listens to it, see, what you're suggesting is there's no showing that there's more than that one that we started with, as if that's the test. The number of people listening to the increased usage don't match, is what you're saying. I don't understand the law to be saying that.
Okay.
It is there, you're using it more, it is available, and I don't understand the law to require the board to show or have to have someone show them there's a match with the increased transmission and the increased number of people who are receiving it.
The reason, Your Honor, is because the assumption of the judges to support this increase in the rate, one of the assumptions, was that there were going to be increased performances. The reason why it matters how many people are listening is that it was the very premise of the judge's reasoning, was that more performances that are compensable under Section 114 were being made, more performances, okay, and that those weren't going to be compensated under the existing rate. So that's why it's different than...
Yeah, but if performance is merely something that's perceptible...
A performance
they're right, as opposed to actually perceived.
I don't agree.
I know you don't agree, but I'm trying to think where you're getting the authority.
U.S. versus ASCAP?
That clearly says you have to match the number of users with the increased use of the copyrighted material. In other words, if the copyrighted material that is being used and transmitted goes from 6 to 18, you have to show that the number of people actually listening to it increased similarly?
It's a two-step argument, Your Honor. The first is the premise is that Section 114 only covers public performances.
Right.
And the judge's assumption was there were going to be increased public performances. Generally, usage doesn't count under 114's public performances. Then you go to U.S. versus ASCAP that says sound recording is being transmitted to a consumer, but they're not listening to it at the same time. It is not a performance to the public. So, therefore, there's no additional performances to the public to the extent nobody listens to these additional channels. As if listening doesn't increase, the very basis the judge has used for the increase doesn't exist under the law. Now, even if there had been additional performance, there was also no evidence in the record, and the judges cited none, that additional performance would go uncompensated. In fact, the judges, in footnote 5 of the revised final determination, specifically found that Music Choice did expect to get increased revenue based on the channel expansion. Music Choice pays on a percentage of revenue, so if it had gotten more revenue, as the judges assumed, and Mr. Delbacaro did testify to that point, although they didn't cite his testimony, more revenues would have been paid. So that finding in that footnote undermines their own justification for the rate increase. And I see at this point I'm past my time.
Thank you.
Your Honor.
Good morning. Sonia McNeil for the government. I'm happy to start wherever the panel would like and answer questions on either half of the case. But unless the panel has a particular place in mind, I'd like to start by addressing a fundamental mischaracterization of the copyright royalty judge's decision process. Sound Exchange suggests that the judge's task is to first find some sort of proto-reasonable rate based on the party's benchmark evidence and then to tinker with it based on the 801B1 factors. That's simply not the way it happens, and it's not the way that it happened in this case. What happened here is the judges evaluated the evidence that the parties submitted, determined the rates that the evidence in the record would reasonably support, then turned to the question of what a reasonable rate would be, a rate that would vindicate the 801B1 statutory factors, and conducted their analysis to arrive at a rate that was reasonable. And reasonable here has a particular meaning.
But I don't know that they're actually arguing that, at least I didn't hear them to be arguing, that you would have to conduct the inquiry in such a way that you start out with market benchmarks and then you proceed down the path. It's just what their argument is, that's what they said they were going to do. And then they did something different. And at that level of generality, if that's true, that does seem like it's arbitrary.
But, Your Honor, that's not true. At the Joint Appendix on 733, the same page that Sound Exchange quoted from, the judges say that what they'll do is consider benchmark evidence, if any. They weren't committing to consider benchmark evidence in any case or evidence that was not probative.
So is your view that the 13% figure, that undoubtedly the 13% was a focal point of the analysis and something that the judges relied on in some measure? You don't take issue with that?
No, Your Honor.
And then is it your view that the 13% just wasn't a market benchmark?
Yes, Your Honor. As you said, the judges never say in their determination that they're relying on it as a market benchmark. They consider it.
If it was not a benchmark?
It was a guidepost, Your Honor. It was a rate that was not irrelevant to the task that was before them. Congress directed the judges to make their determinations based on the record and to act on the basis of prior determinations. This is Section 803A. What the judges did here in this case was consider the record that the parties put before them, take from it what was valuable, and then look for a reasoned basis to come to a conclusion that vindicated the 801B1 statutory factors and was not inconsistent with their prior determinations.
So that statutory language, that leaped out to me too, that 803A1 says prior determinations, but I just don't remember this from your brief, but I know that you focused on the term adjustments as a basis for saying the statute works in an iterative fashion and you take account of past, what's happened in the past, in order to determine where you should go in the future.
Yes, sir.
But did you rely on the prior determinations language in the statute also as a basis for that? I don't mean to suggest that you need to find the exact page because I don't want to quibble at that level, but...
Yes, Your Honor, we did.
You did rely on that.
We did, and we do.
And is your 13% counts as a prior determination because, or as part of the prior determination because the 8 came from the 13?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I ask you a question? Counsel, in responding to me on what it's performed, I think he was citing a case where we're talking about downloading and a file is never opened.
Yes, Your Honor.
As distinguished from this situation, which is quite different, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
You want to play that out? Because I just wanted to check before. That's where the perception versus is what I'm talking about. And I thought that was your position as well. Here the music is being performed. It's a play. It's available. A downloaded file that's never picked up by anyone is not being used, not being performed. Go ahead.
Yes, you're right, Your Honor, and that is our position. Download is not a performance because it's not capable of being contemporaneously perceived by anyone. Whereas here, in contrast, when Sound Exchange increases its music channels by sixfold, more music to afford more choice, its premise is that its service will be more attractive, but the implication of their argument is that there could be a million channels playing music 24 hours a day, and they would have to pay only the same royalty rate, and that's just not right.
The copywriter's decision at times refers to this yawning gap.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it seems like that yawning gap may have been mixing apples and oranges, because the yawning gap talks about 8% as compared to benchmark rates that were proposed but that hadn't been filtered through the four statutory factors yet.
Your Honor, I don't think that it's comparing apples and oranges. What the judges were saying in that portion of the determination was that there was not probative evidence in the record to support the conclusion that the value of sound recordings had increased some three- or fourfold. And so I don't think it's comparing apples and oranges in the way that Sound Exchange suggests. But, I mean, let me be clear. If the objection is that the evidence doesn't line up perfectly, that is the inevitable consequence of the way that Congress structured these proceedings. The way that Congress set it up, and Congress is extremely detailed in the statute, is that parties submit written direct statements offering their view, because that's all a benchmark is. It's an analogy, a way of thinking about the question. The parties propose a way that the judges should think about the question and then take shots at each other during an adversarial proceeding. And at the end of the day, the judges are stuck with the evidence in front of them. They have to make a decision. And I would add, they have to make a decision within a very particular period of time. Congress told them that these proceedings have to be concluded and the rates have to be determined within a certain period.
But even three- or fourfold, if it's not three- or fourfold, is it? Because 8% is what happened at the end of the process, and even the best figure for your purposes in defining the range as something that's more reasonable would be 22. And that's before you go through the factors that assimilate it to disruption and all those other considerations. And at the end of that day, then the rates that resulted were 12 to 20.
Yes, Your Honor. The judge's conclusion, if I understand your point, is that the Sound Exchange's proposal was premised on an increase in the value of sound recordings that wasn't supported. And I would add that this was only one of the judge's critiques of the reliability of Sound Exchange's evidence. When they went on to the 801B1 factors, the gap that they refer to there is in the disruption factor. And they say, in this proceeding, as compared to the last proceeding where we adjusted from down from a rate of 13% to 12%, and that didn't seem to eliminate SiriusXM's business, here the increase that we're contemplating is much more modest. And I think it's worthwhile to note, Sound Exchange isn't here saying that rates between 9 and 11% are unreasonable, or that the judges were irrational to think that these rates were supported by the record.
No, I think what they're saying is that the way the judges went about their analysis is arbitrary. And even if the resulting rates might be reasonable, I think their argument would be, well, that's the whole reason we have arbitrary and capricious review, is you have to be put through the paces. And if you're put through the paces in the correct way, then who knows, you might arrive at a different conclusion at the end of the day. And that, so the fact that the rates, they're not saying that the resulting rates are in some kind of abstract sense unreasonable, I don't think diminishes the potential force of their argument that the process by which those rates were arrived at was flawed.
I understand, Your Honor, but the fact remains, the judges did not use the 13% way in the way that the 13% rate in the way that Sound Exchange characterizes them as having done. And I think if you
and what about their argument that if that what should have happened then is that you should have used 8 instead of 13 as a guidepost?
The judges, of course, used 8. They used 8 among other reasonable guideposts when considering what, for instance, a fair income to copyright users and owners would be under existing
law. So 8 to the exclusion of 13, sorry. So they should have, if what they really meant to take into account is we use as a guidepost the state of the world now, then why not use 8 instead of 13?
It's a curious argument, Your Honor, because if the judges determined in their decision that a 13% rate was relevant and relied on it in part to set rates between 9 and 11%, Sound Exchange's benchmark was unreliable, as they found, and 8% was the only other rate in the record. It's sort of hard to see how they get there. But at any rate,
you mean how they're harmed, because 13 takes out the top end. I mean, I get that, but I think their argument would be that, well, if the judges knew that they couldn't take into account 13, and let's just say for present purposes that they should have taken into account 8 instead of 13, well, then maybe they start looking harder at 22. Or maybe they start getting a better sense of what the top end of the range should be, since they can't consider 13 as part of the mix anymore.
But, Your Honor, I think it's important to remember that the judges did look at 22. They looked at 22 not only when they were evaluating the reliability of the benchmark, but when they were conducting the 801B1 analysis. In footnote 42, in their evaluation of the fourth market, of the fourth 801B1 factor, the judges say it would be difficult to conclude, based on this record, that a jump from the current rate of 8% to a rate of 22 or even as much as 32%, as Sound Exchange proposes, would be sustainable. It's simply not the case that they decided, after evaluating the party's evidence, that Sound Exchange's proposal was no good at all, and then relied on extra record evidence to supplant it. That's simply not how these proceedings work, and it's not how it happened in this case.
Implicit, maybe not implicit, but certainly implicit in your argument is that, look, the standard of review here is very, very, very deferential. This is quasi-legislative. Indeed, some of our cases have suggested that. And unless they come in with something that's really smoking big, you owe us deference. Is that what I'm hearing you right?
Yes, Your Honor. You hear me perfectly. Unless the panel has further questions, the government asks that the panel affirm.
May it please the court, Todd Larson for SiriusXM. I'll start with what the judges did, and there was a question about the 32.32% rate and whether the judges might have gone to that rate if they weren't allowed to use the 13. Let's be clear, the judges looked at the 22% rate and they flatly rejected it, and they made that clear in the opinion. They made it clear in their rehearing order. So it's not the case that they would have defaulted to the 22.32. I think it's important to look at why
you're right. They do take a lot of shots at the 22. They found that rate to be not sufficiently reliable to pin it as the top end of the range. I guess the point would be, if not the 22, if you take out 13, then maybe you're searching for something else. And, you know, the dissenting judge, for example, arrived at 16, I think. And so there is some alternate universe, alternate framework by which taking out the 13 would inure to the benefit of the challengers.
Two responses to that, Your Honor. One, I think it's important to look at the 13% that they took actually grew out of the rejection of the 22. So what happened was Sound Exchange came in with the same expert, the same group of interactive service agreements as a benchmark, and those in the prior proceeding, those agreements had pointed to a rate of 13%. Coming in with those same group of benchmarks and adjusting them in a different way, suddenly he was arguing that they pointed to 22 to 32. And so I think what the judges concluded was that he'd failed to justify how a group of benchmarks that previously had pointed to 13 could point to 22 and rejected it for that basis. And then concluded that they had more confidence in focusing the subsequent 801B analysis in the 7 to 13% range. I think that's different than reaching back and just taking the old rate as a benchmark. It's really about where they were more confident and what was reasonable based on the failure of the expert from Sound Exchange to justify this massive increase. One more point I think we're forgetting here, too. There was a group of 100 agreements presented by SiriusXM in the 5 to 7% range that weren't around in the last proceeding. And the judges, you know, thought those might have some issues, but they didn't reject them flat out, and those were the bottom end of the reasonable range. And so I think those naturally pulled the rate down as well towards the lower end of the range. And so, again, I don't think it's the case that if 13 were just dispatched that you'd automatically jump to 22 or to the 16 that the dissent came up with. You've got something at the bottom end of the range you didn't have last time that the judges found quite credible. And, in fact, in a footnote, lengthy footnote, they went on about the quality of that benchmark despite the flaws that suggested that it might be somewhere above the 7% that those benchmarks pointed to, those licenses. Just one more point in my short amount of time. Counsel for Sound Exchange suggested that when the judges did their 801B analysis, they basically said something to the effect of, well, just take the market rate, whatever it might be, and you don't need to adjust that. I think what the judges did in their 801B analysis was they actually looked at the 8 to 13% range and ran that through the 801B factors, and for at least two of them concluded that the evidence didn't support going above that range. And so it's not, again, the case that if that range had been 7 to 15 or 7 to 16, that they would have necessarily reached that same conclusion. They actually used 13 and said, we don't see a reason under the fair return factor or under the disruption factor to jump above 13%. See, my time is up, so if there are questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Is there any time left for rebuttal? We'll give two minutes total.
I think Judge Santel asked exactly the right question. what is the 13% rate doing in this case if it's not serving as a market benchmark? There is no answer to that question other than 13% was the market benchmark in SDARS 1. It's now being used here. Its connection to the 8% rate, I submit to you, doesn't answer the question of why is it topping out the zone of reasonableness in this case. There's no other explanation for the 13% except as the pair to, as my friend on the other side said, SiriusXM's proposed market benchmarks, which were 5 to 7%. They took 5 to 7% from SiriusXM's benchmarks, which they also found problems with, and then they capped the upper range at 13%, taking the market benchmark from the previous proceeding, even though there was contrary evidence about the current conditions in this case. And I heard some questions going into how do we know this is what they did. I think the best language is on page 733, and it's the JA 733. And they describe their ultimate inquiry as, the issue at hand is whether these policy objectives, the 801B factors, weigh in favor of divergence from the results indicated by the market, by the benchmark marketplace evidence. That's the analysis that the CRJs undertook. It's patent on the face of the opinion. That's an appropriate way, at the level of generality Your Honor pointed to try to set rates in this case. That's what they did. I don't understand how you could complete the sentence, the 13% rate served as X in that analysis, except as a marketplace benchmark. There was also a question from Judge Edwards about the standard of review in cases like this. All I would point out on that score is that government rightly concedes, as it should, that there's still a rationality determination.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's still a Section 803 supported by the written record determination. And Your Honor, actually, in the RIAA case that from a few years back that we cited in our intervener brief, expressly held that the Librarian of Congress, under a similar review scheme, wasn't entitled to look at material outside the record in order to make its decision. And that's the same thing here. If we're going to have this two-step process, which we do, then the 13% isn't playing any role in that process other than as setting a market rate, which is impermissible, not supported by the record, and contradicted by the evidence that was in the record. Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
You're not suggesting that that came as a surprise to you that 13% was being referenced in the proceedings?
As a market rate? Absolutely.
Whether it was not a market rate is another question, but that wasn't a surprise reference. 13% was something you had a shot at, right?
With respect, I disagree. Context matters. If the question is, did Dr. Ordover say that 13% was what the market showed 5 years ago, then yes, of course, we understood that was a state of the world back then.
Right.
But as to whether 13% is the state of the world today?
No, that's the conclusion. You're not suggesting that this just out of the blue, we never even knew anyone had that in their mind.
Well, not as a market rate,
that's self-serving, because there's a question as to whether that's an accurate description. But this wasn't a surprise to you. You got a shot at it. It's like rulemaking. If it's there, you're on notice. You can say whatever you want to say about it, including, you referenced 13%. It should be immaterial in this case, so don't use it. You had that opportunity, right?
I'm going to say no to your question for this reason.
Because it's better to say no than yes, right?
Because there's a good answer, which is why the question is no. Dr. Ordover's benchmark of 22 in this case was critiqued by the other side. Right. As you understand, it's a lengthy process. Mm-hmm. You can't pull back the veils and find a 13% sitting at the core there. It's not as if the adjustments that Dr. Ordover made, if he had just gone left instead of right or gone the same way he had done the last time, you would have ended up at 13%. The world has changed. The contracts that are the basis for this benchmark have changed. And as the dissent pointed out, that when you unpack Dr. Ordover's analysis and take away some things that were the subject of dispute, the number you get is not 13, but 16. We certainly have the ability to dispute 16, but no one, left or right, either side of the V, said that 13% is really the rate that Dr. Ordover is showing in the world today. And that's why it was impermissible for the CRJs to set that as the upper bound of what the market showed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.
All right.